You are entering the Royals Podcast Network.
You call me a good boy, that doesn't mean I don't know.
Welcome into another edition of the Pine Tar Podcast. I am David Leskey. Clint Scholes is on the other side. We are here with you as the Royals currently hold a wild card spot. Still, they're still in the second wild card after beating the Detroit Tigers in Game 3 of their series. The Mariners took a loss today. Today is Sunday. You might not listen to this till Monday, but that's okay. So the Royals are a game and a half up on the Mariners with 7 or 8 games left to be completed, 7 full games left to play. So, exciting time. In all our time recording podcasts, this is going to be the craziest week we've ever done it. And I'm geared up. I have to fly to Miami for a day, which is good and bad, but I'm going to be living and dying with the Royals from that plane. So, from now, let's bring in another guy who lives and dies. I mentioned him earlier. The one, the only, Clint Scholes. How are you, man?
I'm great. Just back from Kansas City myself after going to the home wrap-up game, I guess, the finale.
The regular
season finale, yeah, we'll call it that. I've got my playoff tickets, actually, in if they can get to the division round. That's what I'm hoping for. I've got that ready if needed. Okay. But yeah, they played very good ball today, except for one, you know, minor mistake by Moustakas. Yost did a great job going to the pin early, and they finally slaughtered Detroit at home for what, just the second time this season. Oh.
I want to stop you right there. I was totally remiss in not telling you who our guest is this afternoon, this evening, whenever you're listening. We have Mr. Jerry Krasnick from ESPN.com, who will talk a lot about Ned Yost, a little bit about the rest of baseball and some Royals talk. He wrote an article about Ned Yost about 2 weeks ago, talking about what he's done in his second time as manager. So we'll talk to him here in a little bit. So make sure you're listening to that. It's good stuff. Anyway, back to the weekend. Yeah, lost 2 of 3, got destroyed on Friday, got a little bit a frustrating loss on Saturday, and then came back on Sunday to win the finale. To me, it kept the division hopes, as slim as they are, alive.
Oh, David, they're going to, by the end of tomorrow, they'll be tied.
Oh, from your mouth, man. But yeah, if they were 3.5 out with, you know, the suspended game left to play and all that, there's no way they're winning the division. Now there's pretty much no way they're winning the division, but there is some way they're winning the division. So we got that on our side as Royals fans. The Twins or the White Sox and Tigers play. The Tigers get, I think, Chris Bassett and somebody else you probably never heard of if you weren't a Royals fan and have seen them play, and then Chris Sale. So the good news, and I mention that because Chris Sale pitches Wednesday for the White Sox against the Tigers, which means Chris Sale will not pitch for the White Sox against the Royals. So the Royals are missing Corey Kluber in Cleveland, to just having an insane season, and Chris Sale in Chicago. So if things are going to fall the right way, they've been falling the right way pitching-wise. Now the Royals have to do some work, but so far so good.
Yeah, definitely. And they really missed out on a chance to be a half game out at this point. I mean, they let that game get away from them on Saturday.
Half game up.
Yeah, half game up. I mean, yeah. They let that game get away from them on Saturday. They took care of business on Sunday. It's watching that game today, I mean, Detroit's, it's more than likely that they're going to win this division, but that wasn't that great. That lineup, Detroit just shouldn't do what they've done against Kansas City. Miggy is a shell of himself right now. I mean, the guy, Billy Butler, would beat him on a race to first rather easily at this point.
Oh, yeah.
And then, obviously, they've got other guys in that lineup. You know, they got Kinsler, But after you get past Miggy and JD Martinez, and it's pretty, I don't know why the Royals have struggled to get guys like Castellanos and Rajay Davis and others out so much. But it's and the Royals, but hey, they're in good position right now. The Mariners lost. The Mariners had a, they took, lost what, 2 or 3 down in Houston, and then mm-hmm. they got the series coming up with the Angels. So we got to be happy with where we're at, and hopefully we can hang on to this.
Yeah, it's boy, it's an exciting time. I was hopeful that this weekend the games could have been a clinch series for the Royals, but unfortunately they couldn't keep up their good play from August, and now they got to do some work. But ultimately, what it comes down to, it's pretty simple. Well, I guess it's not completely simple, but it's somewhat simple that they really just need to win one more game than the Mariners win the rest of the season. Now, the Indians are not to be ignored. After play on Sunday, I believe they were,
about 3.5 out of the wild card.
3.5 behind the Royals, who mm-hmm. hold that second wild card. Not to rain on anybody's parade, but there's a, I wouldn't say a bad chance that the Royals lose two games to them in the first day of the series. And that puts them a game and a half back. And that it's still a game and a half with 6 games to play is pretty tough to overcome, but it's not impossible. And the Royals need to take care of business in Cleveland first and foremost. And that means I would like to see them win 3 of 4, including that suspended game. And yeah, it's probably a loss, but if they come back and win that suspended game, that's fine. They can lose another game throughout that series. I just think they need to win as many games as they can, obviously. And they need to make sure that Cleveland is not a player in this playoff race. And that means probably taking them out of the series pretty early. So they're concerning, but once they get out of the picture, it's win one more game than the Mariners win and you're home free. And you know, we haven't been in that situation as Royals fans in quite some time. So maybe the unspeakable will happen and the Royals can use the crazy rules of the suspended game and get some at bats for Eric Hosmer, who's hot, and Josh Willingham, who's not hot but has a chance to hit the ball a long way, and maybe they can pull out a win. Who knows? Stranger things have happened.
Yeah, it's crazy thing is the Royals, you've got a kind of a, you got a matchup tomorrow, not in the suspended game, but in that second game of Carlos Carrasco, who's been really on fire for the Indians as of late, against Danny Duffy, who gets his first game back. So it kind of worked out for the Royals. I was really hoping they were going to use Duffy for this Sunday game.
Me too.
But Guthrie held his own, man. He was solid. Gave him 5 1/3 good work and turned it over to the pen.
Yeah, yeah. I even had a joke about Guthrie on Twitter that I thought would do better, and it didn't. But, you know, that's for another day, maybe. You know what? I'll tell it to you anyway. We'll see. We'll see if anybody is listening who actually follows me on Twitter. The joke was, what's the difference between peanut butter and jam?
What?
Well, it's not the answer you're thinking. It's that Jeremy Guthrie doesn't get himself into peanut butters.
Nice. All right, so on.
I enjoyed that one.
Moving on, folks. Moving on, let's review kind of that home series, David. And obviously, Friday was just a nightmare. And is there anything that stands out to you? I mean, obviously, a 10-1 game, there's not a lot that stands out into some mauling. But that giving Butler the 3-0 green light in that first inning down 3 runs was just a killer.
Yeah, I don't. It kind of goes with what puzzles me about Ned Yost, and he'll say one thing and do another. And basically what he says is that Billy Butler is not good enough to play every day, mm-hmm. but he's good enough to swing 3-0. I mean, there's a strange juxtaposition there. It doesn't quite make sense, because if Billy Butler is not good enough to play every day, then he shouldn't have a 3-0 green light.
Yeah, that's what's boggling to me. I mean, I get 3-0 green light in April. I kind of get that, sure. And it didn't work out for the Royals. But now we went through a whole season of Billy looking not like he did in the past, and to the point of year benching him. And then here, in a huge at-bat, an actual crucial at bat in the first inning. Not saying that they would have won that game, but if they put a couple runs on the board, then maybe they feel like they're
in
it.
The whole thing changes.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and you go out and give him a green light, and then he flies out to a little shallow fly out to right, and the, and basically the rally was killed right there.
Yeah, it puzzles me, and that, yeah, that's the one thing that stood out from that game a little bit. Nice to see Giovitella get a hit in his probably Swamp one of his last top. Chances as a Royal, maybe as a big leaguer even. Just for a guy who personally we like, it was nice to see that he was able to get that. You don't take too much from a game like that.
No, and then Vargas and Sal, it was a bad combination. They went to the well with the changeup just over and over again, and Tigers did a good job of hitting, staying back and punishing it.
Yeah, it's funny because so Vargas' last start was against the Red Sox that last Sunday, and his changeup was otherworldly for the first three or so innings. And then he left one up to Xander Bogaerts, and he deposited it in the bullpen, which is what a good hitter is supposed to do. And Xander Bogaerts is not even a good hitter. And since then, the changeup's been getting hit. The rest of that start, and then on Friday against Detroit. And I don't know what needs to be done, but I think that he needs to stop maybe trying to establish the changeup as a strike. Because I think hitters are looking for it. I think he needs to go more to his fastball. And, of course, with Vargas, if his location's off, he's done. It doesn't matter. But if he can spot the fastball, I think he has to really rely on that a little more than the changeup, because it looks like teams are kind of starting to lean on that changeup a little bit, and it's causing some problems.
Yeah, the Tigers were ready for it. They and their hitters have enough juice to – they can fight off that fastball. Obviously they're sitting fastball, but they can fight it off and just wait for that change. And
well, that's why he's got to be very fine with the fastball and hit his corners. And, and you know, I don't believe, you know, keep the ball down. Hitters can hit down pitches for home runs. That's kind of silly, but make sure that you're hitting your spots and make sure you're putting in a position where if a hitter is going to beat you, it's going to be on in a location that they shouldn't beat you on. And if they do, you hate to say it, but you tip your cap and you move on. But the problem is, I think that changeup is getting too much play, and it looks like teams are kind of getting hip to that, which is odd that it took until September. But the Tigers pounce on it, the Red Sox pounce on it on last Sunday after they'd seen it and swung and missed at it eight times or whatever it was, and it might be time for a new game plan for Vargas. We'll see if they make some adjustments during that Cleveland series, because the Indians are a pretty solid hitting team as well, and they will jump on a mistake. Carlos Santana has no qualms about crushing the Royals, as we all know.
No. Then we turn to the Saturday game, and as electric of a crowd as I've ever seen at the K for a big game.
It was fantastic. I was there.
You were there. And what was that like, Dave? I mean, I'm just watching it on TV. You were there. What was it like?
It was really cool because, so let's see. Shields gave up the home run to Torrey Hunter in the fourth inning,
fourth
I think?
Fourth inning, yep.
Then in the bottom of the fifth, the Royals got the run back. And that Let's Go Royals chant erupted. And I was in my seat, and I literally, I'm sure I looked like an idiot. I had this big, goofy smile on my face, and I was just looking around the stadium, and I'm thinking, I've never been a part of this before. I mean, I'm almost 30 years old, and I have never been a part of an atmosphere like that. And that was the moment when I thought the Royals are winning this game. There's no way they can't. And then they showed us how they couldn't. because in that sixth inning, that the Perez play, when he took off from third and scored, I have never been someplace louder. And I've been to Chiefs games that are supposedly the loudest place on earth, and I had never been a part of a crowd louder than that.
Yeah,
and then I had never been a part of a crowd quieter than that when the call was overturned.
Oh, just brutal. Just the call gets overturned, inning's over, then the Tigers immediately jump on Shields in the next inning.
Yeah, and just to jump on that, I think a lot of that came from Shields sitting for so long.
You're probably right. I mean, that was a long, you know, time in between innings. He definitely after giving up, he gets a strikeout to Castellanos, and something just like changed from there. He walked Suarez, a very weak hitter, walked him on four pitches, and next thing you know, then a pinch hitter comes up. I give Tyler Collins credit. He hit a Shields pitch and did something with it and scored the run, and then Rajay Davis bloops it, and it's 3-1, and it looks like it's the Royals are out, and then they get that run and get a run back in the eighth, got, you know, good position, and then two on in the ninth inning, and biggest at bat of the year, really. And who do the Royals turn to?
Carlos Peña. Oh, wait,
sorry. Yeah, 2 years in a row, they turned to Carlos Peña, Raul Ibañez. It's like, are you kidding me? What are you doing?
See, here's what bugged me about that. People said, well, why wouldn't you bring up Billy Butler? And, you know, I don't have a problem with not bringing up Butler. Butler hasn't hit.
No.
My issue was that he didn't bring up Kane. There were fast runners on second and third, and the Royals were down by one. What happens if a guy gets a single? The Royals win.
Yeah.
So why don't you bring up the guy who's got the best average on the team? I mean, that seems to me to be the logical solution, right?
It makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of hitters on that bench that you could have turned to at that moment.
And I just don't see Raul Ibañez. I don't have a problem with bringing up Raul Ibañez when you need a base runner because he'll work a walk. Or when you need a potential home run because he'll pop a home run here and there. But my issue is when you need a single, why bring up Raul Ibañez? Why not go to Lorenzo Cain, who hadn't played all day, had fresh legs, fresh arms, fresh everything? Why not go to him? You know, I get not going to Billy. He hasn't hit at all in September.
But, yeah, Billy's never hit Joe Nathan very well.
Well, on that too, but why not Lorenzo Cain? Why not give him a shot to see what he can do? You know, I just that puzzled me, and I know that it's funny because Yost cited that Ibañez had a home run off Joe Nathan, but he was 1-for-11. So if you're going to use player versus pitcher splits, then use a better one than Ibañez with Nathan because 1-for-11 isn't good. And especially considering the fact that one hit was a home run and that was your justification, well, they don't need a home run. A home run gives you an extra run. You need a single. Yeah. As Rex Hudler would put it, you need a lousy little single. And then, you know, Lorenzo Cain could have driven the bus, man. I love it.
Yep, and obviously they lost that game. Probably lost their division chances with that loss.
Most likely, yeah.
And then turn around today, and just a solid performance. The crowd really was never a huge factor in today's game, except maybe when Herrera was in. I mean, it was kind of a
filthy.
Yeah, it was kind of a different atmosphere for a whole sold out game or close to. It was never the biggest like crowd involvement all day was the bunt, attempted bunt by Escobar.
The booze, yeah.
Yeah,
well,
the booze.
No, there was never anything going on in that game that warranted a huge crowd involvement. I mean, the crowd erupted during when the Royals scored.
Yeah, and Aoki hits the triple and that got the crowd juice, but I've been in louder games than that.
There just wasn't a lot of tense moments in this one.
No, it was.
And I think the tension really gets the crowd pumped up.
Yeah, and that, you know, you had big game James Shields going against Scherzer in that game, and I think national TV, and I think the crowd knew that, hey, for us to have a chance at winning the division, we have to have this game.
Mm-hmm.
Where today it was, hey, now we're just trying to hang on to the wild card. It's the last. And I think the last home game of the year brings out the casual fan. I know the guy next to me asked me where they're at in the wild card. He had no clue. They left before the end of the ninth. I think a lot of just kind of casual Joes show up to that last game.
Yeah, you know, I talk about that a lot with some friends, and I'm okay with casual Joes wanting to come to the Royals game because it probably means they're good.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and today, for a guy like me, you see the complaints. And obviously, on Saturday's game, there was big video board controversy that you and I talked about off air.
Mm-hmm.
And today, they were completely not putting on any replays. I mean, Gordon makes a spectacular diving catch. They wait until the inning's over to show it on replay. Lots of close plays on stolen bases and stuff. They didn't show it on replay. Close plays at first, they didn't show them. And I think that's why baseball loses the casual fan. They want to see that stuff.
You're probably right. There is nothing to be said for baseball as a game that really doesn't appeal to the twice a year watcher.
Yeah, I mean, this guy next to me, he's like, "Why don't they put that on?" Well, that's why he'll watch it in his living room if he watches it at all. I mean, as opposed to coming up during the game and spending $10 a beer and your ticket, and then staring at his phone the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, but big win, great win today. You know, he bunts Escobar when he probably shouldn't have bunted Escobar. Then he totally, you know, redeems himself by bringing in Herrera in the sixth, and Herrera filthy puts down puts down the same pinch hitter or something, right?
Yeah.
Or was it Holiday? I can't remember.
No, they brought up Collins.
Yeah, they brought up Collins, and he had no answer for Herrera.
You know, so Wade Davis, not to jump off Herrera, because what more can we say about Herrera? Of course, what more can we say about Davis? But he was throwing 98, 99. I don't remember him throwing that hard. I thought it was 95 to 97.
Yeah, he's popped some 97s this year. But yeah, his last two pitches that inning, according to the K-Gun, was 99.
Yeah, that was...
Yeah, he was filthy. And then Holland comes in and quickly wraps it up, no problem.
That's his thing.
Yeah, two Ks, nothing but strikes in the inning. He really looks like his old self. So,
yeah, that little injury could be a blessing in disguise if the Royals make the playoffs.
Yeah, because he looks totally fresh. I mean, he wasn't popping big velo ratings. I think he was 93, 94.
Yeah, that's a little bit concerning to me. I'm looking at Brooks Baseball right now, and he was... So April, his average fastball was about 96.5, May, 97, June, 97, July, 97, August, 97, and September, he's at 95. And so you wonder what's going on there. But, you know, for now, I think we'll have to trust it. But since he's come back, so he pitched on 9-3 was his last game before he went down for about a week and a half. And his average fastball was about 95. And in his first game back against Boston, what was that? Last Saturday, I want to say. 94.3, and then today, or I'm sorry, the other day against the White Sox, he was at 94. Doesn't have his data from today, Sunday's game yet, but I imagine it was about there based on what I was watching. So that's something to be concerned with, maybe, but he's effective. So I think Holland has enough movement, and he relies enough on his secondary pitches that his fastball velocity doesn't have to be at his top level for him to be a good pitcher, a great pitcher.
No, it doesn't. He was lights out today. I think MLB threw like 9 pitches. I mean, 8 for strikes. But he did go against a couple of young bucks and Steven Moya and Suarez, so he made him look awful.
That's fine.
Yeah, that's good. And that's something you and I will talk about in the offseason. We've talked about they probably need to trade Greg Holland. So
yeah,
if his velo's heading downwards, that's a good reason to probably look into that. But so it sets him up for a huge series in Cleveland, and I think that not really the suspended game, but that first game, Duffy Carrasco, is about as big as it gets for ending Cleveland season.
Yeah, like we mentioned, the Indians are not that far back, and if they get some momentum, and let's say they win 2 games in the first day of that series, then they're a game and a half back, and I don't want to have to deal with another team, because even if the Mariners, let's say the Mariners lose tomorrow and the Indians win their 2 games, obviously, then you got the Mariners are a game back and the Indians are a game and a half back. And now it's a 3-team race for that second wild card, really a 4-team race for the 2 wild cards, because Oakland struggled so much. And you don't want the Indians in there. It's as much as I think the Royals are a better team than them. A lot of weird things happen, and you don't want it. So the Royals need to get a win tomorrow. or today if you're listening on Monday again. they need to get a win, and they need to set the tone for that series. And like I said, they need two wins. Three wins would be awesome, because you want to bury the Indians. You don't want them to go into that final weekend thinking they have a chance.
No, I agree. But I think this is a good time to bring in Jerry Krasnick, and then we'll talk on the back half.
We are now joined by the one, the only, Jerry Krasnick from ESPN and ESPN.com. Jerry, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. Thank you for taking a little time with us today. We thought you'd be a really good person to talk to about the Royals because, what, it was about a week and a half ago, you wrote an article about our very own Ned Yost, the lovable Ned Yost. You know, I was reading through that, and I found myself just shaking my head, and yeah, he's pretty gruff, and nodding and agreeing with pretty much everything you wrote there. I just kind of want to jump in with the first question of, you know, you talk about the clubhouse and what Yost has done differently, and I've seen it a little bit from my time in the clubhouse. What exactly does Yost do behind the scenes that separates him from other managers? Because you hear a lot that Ned Yost is a guy the players love and you know, all that good stuff. So what exactly does Ned Yost do to be so, I guess, beloved in that clubhouse?
Well, I think he brings a lot of Bobby Cox to the equation. You know, he was a Bobby Cox disciple and worked for him for, what, 11 or 12 seasons. And, you know, so he takes some of Bobby's philosophies and puts those into practice. And I think the big thing is, you know, Bobby was a guy who believed very much in, I don't want to say protecting the players, but he would never rip the players publicly. He would never call them out in the newspaper with the media. And, you know, sometimes you can almost think that he's enabling them a little bit. You know, he covers for them. And, but I think, you know, Ned told me, he said, look, that doesn't mean I don't bring a guy in and air him out in my office. But I do think players kind of appreciate that. When you don't publicly blame them for things and call them out. And, you know, I think in some respects, he probably takes lumps for things. You know, as I mentioned in my story, I think if a reliever says to Ned, look, I can't go tonight. I just, you know, I pitched 2 days in a row and I can't. He's not going to say, hey, this guy told me he couldn't go. He's going to make it look like it's his decision. So in that respect, I think sometimes managers put up with things that we don't normally know about. You know, obviously, and again, I think the players told me, you know, that they like Ned. That's my understanding. You know, whether that's entirely true or some of it is happy talk, you never really know. I mean, I'm sure there are players who have issues with him just like any other manager. But I do think, by and large, he's a more positive presence with the players in the clubhouse than he is around us in the media.
You talk about that positive presence. Can you tell fans what it's like for a team to be around? You interact with a lot more than just the Royals. What's that mean to a team for a long season like the baseball season is?
Well, look, I just think, you know, I think sometimes we get hung up on the strategy, you know, and I get it. I understand that, you know, Ned might bunt too much or his batting orders might defy logic or he might, you know, go with a different bullpen piece. But, you know, I just don't think people understand sometimes or aren't really interested in the thought that a workplace in baseball is like a workplace anywhere else. You know, you have a lot of different personalities, a lot of different characters. You might have guys who lose confidence easily. You might have negative, whiny, complainy veteran guys who can get the, you know, younger kids off to the side and divide a clubhouse. I mean, there's a million things that managers have to deal with day in and day out that aren't really reflected in the moves during the game. And I think a manager who is consistent and, you know, a largely upbeat helps the team because, you know, in baseball there are so many peaks and valleys and, you know, slumps and that sort of thing. It's more of a mental game, I think, than other sports just because of the nature of the schedule. So I think if you have a guy who the players feel is supportive and a generally positive presence, you know, it's going to wear well better over 6 months. You know, if you have a guy who's maybe critical or a guy who's not in the clubhouse and doesn't listen to players and doesn't relate, you know, that stuff can have an impact over time.
You mentioned relationships with players and all that, and there's a question that I think most fans in Kansas City have, and it's, is there a rift between Ned Yost and Billy Butler?
You know, it's odd because, you know, I see a lot of that stuff online, and there does appear to be something going on there where he sat him down at crucial junctures, I guess, right? And so, you know, I don't know if that's the case, but I do know I've seen Andy McCullough and, you know, some of the people around the team, I think, have asked Butler about lineup decisions, and Butler's like, well, I don't have any comment on that. Well, sometimes that's indicative that maybe there is something going on behind the scenes. And, you know, I do think Ned has that reputation from his Milwaukee days, I think, as a guy who might overreact to things and, you know, panic. You know, that's something that he has to live down. In his defense, I think, you know, people say, well, players might complain about some of his lineup decisions. I don't know where I'm going to be on a given day. I do think with this Royals lineup, he kind of has to try to change things up a lot because it's not a very good offensive club. You know, I think if he had a steady lineup from 1 through 9 where he didn't have to make changes and tinker with things, he would probably prefer it that way. As far as Billy Butler, I don't know. I'm not around the team that much, but there does appear to be some sort of something going on beneath the surface there in terms of Butler's usage and not using him in key spots that makes you think twice.
You talk about his panic and the days back in Milwaukee. Is he a little too wound up, a little too wound tight? Because it really does seem like the best part of this team, the defense, has been really tight this past couple weeks.
Yeah, you know, I think, look, I was around them a little bit in Milwaukee before he got fired. I think they took a trip into Philly. And, you know, Ned's public persona is such that he, as he told me in the story, it's not his favorite part of the job. You know, and with a manager, sometimes the vibe he displays is the way he deals with questions and strategy and that sort of thing. And I think Ned's natural inclination is to roll his eyes or be sarcastic, or, you know, if he thinks a question is dumb, his body language kind of reflects it. And, you know, I think in Milwaukee, he did sort of convey an air of panic. There was that 1 year, I think, where he got thrown out of 3 games in the final week, you know. So, but I do think he really did take that time off after his, you know, firing in Milwaukee and tried to learn and, you know, change for the better. And I don't think he's quite the same guy now. He's kind of a, you know, he's a different breed of cat. He's just different than some other people. He can be terse and he, you know, he can be a little bit difficult. But like I said, I don't get the feeling, at least I didn't when they were in New York, when I saw him, that there was any kind of a tension in the clubhouse or that sort of thing. No, I saw them a couple weeks ago, and whether things have changed, you know, between then and now, I have no idea.
So you talked about kind of figuring things out and learning things second time through. And I remember an article, it was an ESPN magazine, God, maybe 10 years ago, about the best NFL head coach candidate. And I think it was Marty Morningweg, because he had the perfect combination of past experience and failure and all that. And you look at the managers around baseball, and there's, what, 11 or 12 guys who are in their second, third, fourth stints as managers, and most of them are pretty successful. So what is it about that second time? What are they able to learn and take with them that allows them to be successful that second, third, and fourth, and fifth times through?
Well, you know, you're kind of lucky sometimes to get that second or third or fourth time, and a lot of times the first time you're not with a very good team. I mean, how many guys get their first job with a team that's ready-made, you know, to win? I think, you know, one thing I think people don't always understand is the speed of the game. You know, you're in the dugout, and there might be things going on, you know, 3 innings from now that you have to be aware of and, as a manager. And, you know, if you don't have a great bench coach or a lot of experience, then all of a sudden these things can come up on you pretty fast. You know, you don't have a reliever ready, or, you know, you get out matched by, you know, somebody who's really good. So I think that the speed of the game, I know it sounds weird with baseball because it seems so deliberate, but I think those moves you have to be prepared for. And, you know, I just think a manager becomes more comfortable with himself. You know, when you get fired and you're out of work, I think the second time you get a job, you're probably not quite as defensive. You know, I think when you're in your first job and you're worried about getting fired, all of a sudden you're managing not to lose. You know, you're conveying an air of tension. And I think getting fired a couple times is probably kind of liberating, you know, for some of these guys, Joe Torre and Buck Showalter. And you could tell, you know, the second or third team, all of a sudden they're like, what are they going to do, fire me? You know, so they've already been fired. So I think once you get past that fear and that sort of tension about losing your job, you can be yourself a little bit more and maybe be more of an effective manager.
So going forward with this club, this team right now, game and a half ahead of the Mariners for that second wild card, but they do have a tough series with the Indians. How do you like their possibilities of hanging on to that wild card lead?
You know, I kind of changed day to day, but I really, you know, I was looking at Seattle. You know, Seattle travels a lot of air miles. I mean, they have probably twice as much as a lot of teams, and I think that can wear you down a little bit. They have to go to Toronto and play, which is not a particularly easy place to go. And the other problem with Seattle is their pitching is really starting to fray. You know, Chris Young looks like he's gassed. I think Roenis Elias might be done for the year now, or at least for the regular season. Something happened to him, I think. And Iwakuma has not pitched well. He looks like his tank is pretty much empty. So, you know, Seattle relies so much on pitching, they might be in trouble. And Oakland's been terrible. You know, they beat the Phillies on Sunday, but they've been awful. So, I think if the Royals can win 4 out of 7 this week, or, you know, I think play the White Sox too, right? You know, they're still playing okay. They really should have won that game against Detroit on Saturday. But I think they have a pretty good chance, just because I think the other two teams have been so bad, and Seattle's main strength is its pitching, and it looks like it's in trouble. The door's really wide open for Kansas City to walk through.
Do you think they have any shot at this division, being a game and a half down with a week to go?
I don't think that's going to happen. I just think Detroit is one of these teams. They're not great. I mean, I watch them, and they can be exasperating, and Joe Nathan drives you crazy. But they seem to be one of these teams that when they get in a spot, they're going to win that game. You know, and I just don't know that the Royals quite have that toughness or self-belief that they're going to do that. So I have a hard time seeing Kansas City overtaking Detroit over the next week, but I do think they have a pretty good chance at the wild card, and I could be wrong. I mean, maybe Detroit stumbles here in the last week, but I think it's going to be a challenge for them to overtake them.
Well, if they do make it in the wild card, I was at today's game, and two baffling moves, and one baffling move by Yost. He's got two on, no outs. He makes Escobar bunt. That ends up almost costing him. But then later in the game, when Guthrie kind of on the fence, he goes, makes the correct move with Herrera, bringing him in a little bit early. What do you think of him in the playoffs? How would he perform, Yost?
Well, the funny thing is Bobby Cox was criticized at times for being excessively loyal to guys, even when they struggled, which is why I guess it's puzzling with this Billy Butler thing. And I've only watched it peripherally, but I guess what, he hit a Baez, I think, in a big spot Saturday instead of Butler, and he seems to sit him down at times. You know, the other thing with Ned, I mean, look, I understand the, you know, the furor over his bunting and different things, but sometimes you have to blame the players too. You know, for instance, like with Infante, I mean, Ned gets this big brunt of, you know, he's hitting him in the second spot and he won't take him out of the second spot. Well, and Fonte's making, what, $32 million for 4 years, and he's got about a 280 on base, a 550 OPS since the All-Star game. In Kansas City, it almost seems like people are so obsessed with the manager and his failings that they never get on the players. And in that respect, Ned might almost be doing a favor for these guys because he's such a lightning rod. But I do get it. I'm not a huge fan of the bunt all the time. And, you know, I thought they did Scherzer a favor on Saturday. It's like, look, if you got him on the ropes early and you can score three runs, then don't sacrifice an out and play for one run. And but yeah, he did. I did notice the game today. He brought in Herrera, I think, what, in the sixth inning, right, to get an out or two. And so I do think Ned has to, you know, be not so doctrinaire and manage a little bit more to the moment as opposed to by the book. But he's not the only guy who does it that way. I think a lot of managers do it that way now, just because there's so much second guessing. And if you do it a certain way, you can always fall back on the crutch of, well, this is the way we did it all season. So, you know, he might do it a little bit more obviously than some people, but I think it's more commonplace than people think.
You know, when Royals fans listen to this, they're going to chastise me for saying this, but don't you think Ned Yost deserves a little credit for changing his ways in the midst of the pennant race? Because just last week, just last Sunday, he brought in Aaron Crow in the sixth inning and said that inning is not Kelvin Herrera's. And then we saw what happened in the finale of the Detroit series. He brought in Kelvin Herrera. So doesn't he get some credit for saying, okay, I was wrong, and doing something a different way?
Yeah, you know, I think with Ned, a lot of times it's not so much the move he makes as the way he explains it, you know, mm-hmm. the way he articulates it. And, you know, I remember early in the season, and I looked this up for my story, but I think there was a sequence with Alcides Escobar in like one of the first games of the year where he let him hit against Scherzer late in the game and he made an out. And people said, how could you let him hit? And Ned said, well, I don't want to get in his dome. You know, and what he was saying, I think, was, look, I need this guy all year. If I take him down for a pinch hitter 2 days into the season, that could really have an impact on a guy's confidence, you know. And if he explained it a little bit better, I think people should be willing to say, hey, he knows his players, and maybe this was a smart move, or maybe, you know, you have to think long term. Ned will explain it in such a way where he talks about the third base tree or different things that are easy to mock. And, you know, I just think it becomes a little bit of an obsession after a while. And this is not a great team. I guess that's my point is, yeah, they have a really good bullpen. Most of the time they have a really good defense. James Shields is, you know, terrific in big spots, but they don't hit very much. The rotation is not that great. And he still has them in the mix. You know, it's a flawed team. And if they get to the postseason, he'll probably get some Manager of the Year votes. So I think in Kansas City, everybody's scrutinizing him very closely. But when you look at the overall picture, you know, I think it's pretty hard to blame him if they don't make it or if they just squeak in. Like I said, I just don't think the team is quite as great as everybody's making it out to be.
No, I don't. I think you're right on there. From an outside perspective, are us Royals fans, are we just kind of all crazy? Or what? I mean, what is it? It just seems like we do put a little bit too much on Yost and Dayton Moore.
Yeah, look, these guys aren't, you know, every move they make isn't perfect. Then again, you know, they did have a plan in place. Dayton's plan was to get athletic players to focus on, you know, guys who could defend in that ballpark, get some hard throwers in the bullpen. You know, it's been a fun season for Royal fans regardless. You know, it's probably been a little bit too stressful. You know, I just think the focus on the manager in certain cities is to me, Ned Yost is probably 1 and 1A, you know, the most scrutinized manager in baseball, and Freddy Gonzalez might be after him. But when you start looking at other cities, you know, Mike Matheny gets criticized a lot in St. Louis. You know, Clint Hurdle, I asked the question on Twitter recently, and I heard all these people in Pittsburgh saying, we can't stand watching Glenn Hurdle manage. And I'm like, well, last year they made the playoffs, and this year they're probably going to make the playoffs after two decades. So, yeah, he might make some moves that drive you crazy, but look at the whole. You know, look at how guys run balls out, or look at how, you know, the effort they put in, or the way they, you know, seem to play with respect for the game or whatever, you know, those kinds of things. And those are a reflection on the manager too. So, you know, I just think to focus completely on Ned Yost bunting too much, or the construction of his batting order, or when he uses a guy in a game, yeah, that's an important part of what he does, but it's not all that he does as a manager.
Now, I've heard from some people who I would consider pretty smart about this game of baseball, say that it looks like the Royals have just kind of run out of steam a little bit offensively. Yeah, just the at-bats they're having and just everything about their game. Do you see that with them, or do you think that's a little bit crazy?
Well, this is a team that wasn't great at the start of the year, and then they got better when they switched hitting coaches. I do think, like with Salvador Perez, to me, he's run out of gas.
Yeah.
He, you know, there's a guy who, he's a big guy, and he, I think he's started, what, 135 games behind the plate, I think, or something.
Something like that, yeah.
You know, I think he's fried. You know, and the problem is a guy like Butler, you know, you'd like to have him hit 25 home runs and take some pressure off, and he just hasn't been that kind of hitter. And I do think there's a carryover effect. You know, if your main guys aren't hitting, you get these other guys like the, you know, the younger guys like Hosmer or Moustakas who struggles against lefties, or, you know, and so there is a contagious effect. But I do think you look at that team, and it's a team that really, there's an emotional toll when you have to play every single day, and you know it's probably going to be 3-2, 2-1, you know, 4-3 if it's a slugfest. So I do think that team's running out of gas, but I also think that the Mariners are running out of gas, and the A's have looked like they've run out of gas. So they're all sort of in the same predicament right now.
You talked earlier about how this really is not that great of a team. It's kind of a flawed team. I watched the Tigers today, and Miggy's hobbling down to first. Is there a great team in the AL?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think the Angels are a really good team, but again, you just, when you look at this classic, you know, built for October scenario, and you look at their rotation, you just say, is that a rotation that scares you going into October? And I don't think so. I think the Orioles are a really good team. You know, and strangely enough, I think their starting pitching might be good enough. When you look at the offenses of some of the other clubs, their problem now is that they have to deal with the loss of Matt Wieters, Manny Machado, and Chris Davis. I mean, I think if you put those three guys all in the lineup, I would, you know, pick the Orioles as my AL favorite. I just think it's going to be interesting to see if, you know, the Steve Pierce and Ryan Flaherty and, you know, whoever, Alejandro Diaz and these guys, how they're going to be able to hit in October against really good pitching. You know, but the Orioles, this might be the year that the Orioles can get through a round or two, even with starting pitching that, you know, most people don't think of as upper crust.
All right. Well, that brings me to our final question. Then we will let you go. And thanks again so much for taking time for us. You think the Orioles might be the best team in the American League, best chance to win the pennant. Who's your World Series pick?
Well, you know, I picked St. Louis at the start of the season, so I guess if I were true to myself, I'd probably pick them. I think Washington is probably the best team going right now. I mean, they seem to be peaking at the right time. They got a pretty deep lineup, and Drew Storen's been great in the bullpen, and they really do have, you know, a great starting pitching. So, I mean, I guess if I look at the best teams right now, they seem like the team that's best equipped to make a deep run in October, and, you know, the chance of a Washington-Baltimore World Series would be kind of cool, but, you know, I think there's probably as good a chance of that matchup as really any other one that we might see.
It is interesting because there's a, as of right now, there's a lot of cross-state, cross-area World Series possibilities out there. Royals, Cardinals, Nationals, Orioles, Giants, Dodgers, Dodgers, Angels, all that. So should be pretty exciting. Yeah, again, thank you so much for taking time with us. We really appreciate it, and great stuff. We hope to have you on again soon.
Sure, guys. Have a good night.
Thanks, Jerry. You too. That was Jerry Krasnick from ESPN.com. Big thanks to him for coming on. Always nice to get the national perspective on the boys in blue and Ned Yost. It seems to me that I don't know that I would say go as far as say he's a big fan of Ned Yost, but I think he kind of echoes what you and I have talked about a lot, in that it's not always the manager. Sometimes the players have to perform. And, you know, we talk about, in his article, he talks about Joe Torre. And I've talked about that before, too. Joe Torre was a dog as a manager until he got hired by a team with talent. And then now he's a Hall of Fame manager. So, I don't know. I kind of agree with Krasnick to some extent, that a lot of people think Ned Yost is responsible for all the Royals' woes. But, I mean, look what he has to choose from sometimes in that offense.
Oh, it's kind of brutal, I mean, day to day. I mean, other than – I just think of where this offense would be if Aoki wouldn't have caught fire against the White Sox and Hosmer –
I don't want to think about it.
Yeah, and Hosmer hitting well. I mean, this offense would just be just chucking it right now, because Sal Perez is a mess.
Oh, he's awful. He's probably the worst hitter on the team right now.
He might be the worst hitter in the major leagues right now.
At this particular moment, perhaps.
He is brutal. His at-bats today were just awful.
They all are. They're all terrible at-bats.
Yeah, he put together no good at-bats today.
I mean, he's a guy, he walks the plate, and we talked with Jerry about it. He walks up to the plate, and it looks like he's going, I just want to get back to sit down. All I want to do is sit down.
And he's
hitting like it, too.
Yeah, I mean, everything's turning. He's trying to turn on everything. And
that's not him. That's not his game.
No, he should be able to use the whole field. And I just don't get it. The guy, he's spent physically, I think. They need to sit him. I understand you don't want to sit him, but he needs to sit. He's not helping this team. And, yeah, he's a good defender, but it's not worth it.
His defense has suffered, too, as he's gotten a little more tired. And I was looking it up, and there are only – three catchers in baseball. I put this in Friday notes last week or 2 weeks ago or something. But it's interesting. There are still the same, only three catchers in baseball to get 120 starts or more this year. It's Salvador Perez, Miguel Montero, and Jonathan Lucroy. And all three of them have OPSs in the second half that are at least 100 points lower than their OPS in the first half.
Yeah, it's not
a coincidence. No. I mean, there's a correlation there. So, and at this point, you're not going to be able to recover Salvador Perez's bat, because the way to do that would probably be to sit him through the Cleveland series, and they're not doing that.
No, but it really wouldn't be bad to sit him at least one of those games. But Ned won't do it.
I haven't looked at the pitching matchups yet. And
Kratz has hit right-handers for the Royals.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think against Carrasco, I wouldn't mind seeing Perez sit, although I think they're going to want Duffy working with Perez. But, I mean, I haven't seen who's pitching yet, but I would sit him against a couple righties.
Yeah, he could really use it. Hosmer looks good today. Aoki looked...
Hosmer's plate discipline is back.
Yeah, and Escobar looked really good at the plate today when he wasn't bunny. And
the thing about Escobar to me... And this is probably going to get derided if anybody gets their hands on listening to this, but Escobar has such good bat control when he's going good that he can flick balls foul, and that's what made his 2012 so good. And I remember watching him, and you're going, well, he shouldn't swing. Okay, it's a foul ball, so he's exhaling the at bat, and then he gets a pitch that he can pop into right center field for a single. And it's not necessarily a sustainable way to hit, but when he is hitting well, that's what he does well. He fouls balls off until he gets a pitch that he can bloop into the outfield, and occasionally he'll do more than bloop one like he did today.
Yeah, he turned on that ball, just missed a home run by a couple of feet, and that's what was mind-boggling, why you would bunt him in a big spot later. But this team does have a couple weapons, and I got to see one of the weapons today in Terrence Gore, and whoa, that kid is blazing fast.
He can run a little bit.
Oh my God, he took off for second, and then he created the passed ball. I'm pretty sure he created the passed ball when he got to third, because Holiday was looking to be quick.
Yeah.
Because Holiday blocked everything all day, and then Gore gets on second, and boop, ball gets away, Gore's at third.
Yeah, that's a nice weapon to have. Too bad he can't hit.
Yeah, it's really too bad he can't hit. But so what they can do, what Ned Yost has to do, is he's got to figure out a way to use the offensive weapons he has, and hopefully Gordon's double today will get him going, because he's struggling.
Oh, he's been awful. That's his 10th hit of September.
Yeah, he's been brutal this month, and Sal's been brutal. Billy Butler still does not look good. He had a couple hits today, but...
Well, the first hitting single was vintage Butler.
That was, but...
But the rest of the game, it just wasn't. And he swung at the first pitch, and I don't have a problem with first pitch swinging like some people do. It's about your selection of what to swing at. But if you swing at a pitch that you can drive, I'm okay with it.
Hey, he went out first pitch swinging today, and normally against starters, he takes a lot of first pitches.
Yeah.
But he didn't wait
maybe,
around
maybe
today.
He's actively trying to change his approach because it's not working.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't wait around today. He went out, he got the first pitch, hit it, knocked it right through the middle. That was great. And the Royals needed that. They needed to find a lead today.
Yeah, with this team, I think there's a lot mental involved. I think that there's here we go again and we'll never lose, kind of depending on how they're going.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. Maybe this game can be a mental springboard, because even, you know, I talked about it on I think it was last Monday was the game that they won on the infield single by Kane. I mean, if this game doesn't get them going, I don't know what will. And then I started thinking about that, and, you know, maybe not, because I could see that clubhouse, and I've been in that clubhouse a few times, and I know that sometimes they can be as cynical as us, truthfully. And I wonder if they're going, yeah, we won, but it wasn't, our offense is still not doing it. And there's a mental aspect to it. Nobody's hanging their head in there or anything, but... there are guys who they know what's going on. Some of these guys aren't maybe the sharpest knives in the drawer, but a lot of them are pretty smart, and they know that yes, the Royals' offense is not very good. And today's game, they put together some good at bats. They hit the ball hard. This could be the type of game that they say, "Oh yeah, I forgot we can do that," and start to hit a little bit.
I really hope so. I hope they see that. You know what? If we tax a starting pitcher and make him throw 50-odd pitches in the first couple innings, it's good for us.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, they did really take good at-bats. They didn't draw a lot of walks today, but they made him work.
Yeah, Porcello had, what, 190 pitches or something in four innings?
I don't know what he finished up with. I just know he was at 54 at the end of two. I mean, they grinded it out on him. Not drawn a lot of walks, I think. Can't even really think. I know Hosmer got intentionally walked, and I can't think of another walk. I'm sure they had another
okay, Porcello threw 80 and 3 1/3.
Yeah, I mean, they grinded him. It was a grind for the kid.
They had Aoki, Hosmer, and Infante had a walk. I guess Dayton Moore told Infante to walk.
Yeah, so it was a grind, and good at bats, and even when they weren't walking, they were guys going deep into counts, and they didn't hit him hard, but they found holes, and they got some bloops, and then they got the running game going. Kane had a steal. Gore had a steal. Eske got tossed out at second. That kind of hurt, but they were going first to third on some stuff. So it was for how the team needs to win, that was about as blueprint as it gets.
Yeah, that's the team that Dayton Moore has built. And on the subject of Dayton Moore, A little tidbit came out from Ken Rosenthal on Twitter, and then I saw it on MLB Trade Rumors on Saturday, I want to say, that the Braves are kind of looking to reshuffle their front office potentially, and that they might be interested in reuniting with Dayton Moore, who was John Schirolt's original choice to succeed him before Dayton Moore became the Royal General Manager. Very interesting to me, because, you know, it would make a lot of sense for the Braves in that, you know, it apparently Frank Wren has run his course there, and they've really tanked this season. I mean, you want to talk about a collapse. People don't talk about it because the A's collapse is much bigger, but the Braves were in playoff position, and they are brutal now. So that's a pretty big collapse that I somebody's got to lose their job for, and it might be Frank Wren, and might want to bring home Dayton Moore to work with his old mentor. And I don't know. I think that could actually be really good for the Royals. I think you all know that I'm not a Dayton Moore fan. He's done a nice job putting together a roster to compete for a playoff spot, but I think a lot of it's in spite of his roster management. So, yeah, interesting little tidbit to come out of Ken Rosenthal this weekend.
Yeah, that's very interesting. That team has fallen apart, and the team's not. I mean, that team isn't built that much differently than the Royals.
Very, very similar. Yeah. Good defense. The Braves have more power.
Yeah, they have more power, and it's just a case of their Upton moves have been terrible for them.
Well, Justin's been good.
Justin's been good, but BJ's been a bomb.
Oh, I mean, he's been so bad that they went out and acquired Emilio Bonifacio to play every day in center field, basically.
Yeah, and then they've made other mistakes that have cost the team money. Guys like Dan Uggla, that cost him a lot of money. He bombed out. I think Jason Hayward has been a disappointment. Yeah, he's kind of very a la Alex Gordon in that a lot of his values derive defensively. Mm-hmm. And I think that team, they wanted much more offensively out of him. And so the team's built very, I mean, you stack that team next to the Royals, they're very similar, except that their first baseman hits a little bit more. It's kind of scary how similar.
Well, it's
that
even
team
scary
is.
How much Freeman looks like a combination of Hosmer and Moustakas.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know. They're not built that poorly, I guess. They're just in a tough division, in that there's more talented teams in that division. And
well, there's another bad contract too. I was just looking it up while you were talking because it popped in my head. Chris Johnson, he had a fairly fluky season last year, and then Frank Wren went out and gave him a 3-year, $23.5 million deal with a 2018 team option for what's the number here? I had it up. Sorry. For $10 million. So you look at things like that, and he's responding by putting up numbers that are befitting of, you know, Chris Johnson.
Yeah, I mean, that deal's just not a killer, though. I mean,
no, but it's one of those. It adds to the list.
Yeah, I just don't know. They've ran into injuries in the bullpen that have hurt. I just don't see a major weakness in the team. They've just not played well. I think their managerial choice is the biggest problem with that team, to be honest with you. I just don't. I look at that roster and I see Julio Teheran, nice young player to go with. You went out and you got Harang, and you got a fluky season out of Harang, but he's pitched well, and you've done well with him. Irvin Santana's pitched decently well for them. They got a nice young pitcher in Alex Wood, and they've got, I guess there's been some problems in development with that team as far as what they should, seems like they should have more young starting pitching than what they've had.
Well, and you look at the lineup, Anderson Simmons has not followed up last year with taking a step forward offensively like they thought he would.
No, but you can live with that season at your shortstop when he's that good defensively.
Oh, no, absolutely. But I think that they were expecting more out of him because of what he did last year.
Yeah, but you got to – I think fans need to temper expectations offensively now in this new run environment.
Well, and that's true, too. I mean, you look – I talked about that before, that I think it was I used – Billy Butler last year and Angel Baroa in 2003, that they had very similar OPSs, and Billy Butler's OPS plus was like 16 points higher.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it's even bigger this year. So you're right. They have nice pieces. The Braves do. Mike Minor took a little bit of a step backwards this year.
That was a big one. That
was
hurt
tough.
Quite a bit.
But the bullpen, they had injuries, but I mean, David Carpenter's been solid for them. Anthony Vivaro has been pretty good for them. Jordan Walden stepped up and pitched pretty well. And I mean, they've had injuries, but they've been able to cover for those. I think that you're right. The biggest issue with that team is the manager. And And I don't know. I think that Frank Wren deserves some responsibility for hiring that manager.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I mean, Freddie wasn't liked at the Marlins. So to go out and hire this guy after that debacle, it just didn't make sense. And then to give BJ Upton that deal. It's a huge deal. I mean, they're giving him, what is it? They're giving almost 560 right in there. I mean, that's killing them. The kid has been brutal from the start of that deal. He's hitting 208 with a
Try 5 and 75.
Oh my God. And he's hitting 208 with a 282 on base and just an ugh every day. And for the most part, Freddie's put him at the top of the lineup.
Mm-hmm. So it's a joint comment. I mean, it's very similar to Omar Infante.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously on a much smaller scale, but it's Omar Infante was given a long-term deal by the general manager, and he was used poorly by the manager.
Yeah,
and BJ Upton was given a long-term deal by the general manager and used poorly by the manager.
And then you look around the diamond for what the Royals do and what the Braves do. The Braves have good – I think Upton's a solid defender. I'm not looking at his metrics, but I'm sure they're not Lorenzo Cain-esque.
No, but they're good.
Yeah, and then left field, they don't have an Alex Gordon, but up
– But right field they do.
Yeah, and Justin Upton is your left fielder, so you're better off offensively. I just think they're in a – tougher division than the Royals are.
That's part of it. I think they made some bad decisions. I think they have some deficiencies and some injuries. And
when you have a weak manager, it's going to hurt you more in the National League than it is in the AL.
That's true. That's very true. And it's just interesting to me that the Braves would look to bring in a guy who would probably build a team very similarly to Frank Wren.
No, I don't think he'd do it any differently. He'd just probably hire a different manager.
Yeah, which could be the difference, although, let's be real, Dayton Moore's managers haven't exactly been the most inspired choices. So, I look at Dayton Moore, and I see three managers he's hired, because Buddy Bell, he could have easily said, nope, we don't want you, and gone with his own manager in 2007, but instead he actively kept Buddy Bell as manager. So I look at that as a Dayton Moore hire, in a way. In terms of looking at what Dayton Moore chooses for a manager, and that, to me, that's three whiffs, and I don't know that he would do much different than Frank Wren in Atlanta, but it would be interesting because then you question where do the Royals go, and you look back at the last GM search, and it was under different circumstances, obviously, because they fired their general manager, where in this case they'd be just losing their general manager, and Dayton Moore was the number one GM candidate at the time. Does David Glass go that route again? Does he go outside the organization? Or does he promote from within? And that brings up a point that's something that I'd heard for a while back from somebody, I can't remember who. The Royals have never gone outside the organization for a general manager. And you might say, well, they hired Dayton Moore from the Braves. And yes, but hang on. Basically, they went from, Cedric Talas, Joe Burke, to John Schultz, to Herc Robinson, to Allard Baird, all from the system. And then when they fired Allard Baird, they went and got Dayton Moore, who learned from John Schultz.
Yeah, they've all stayed on the tree.
And so it might not be a bad idea for this organization to say, all right, you know what? It's 2015, for all intents and purposes, if this happens. Let's go out and see what David Forst might take, although he's in line for Billy Beane's job. But you know what I mean. Let's take a look. There's a guy with what's his name? He's with the A's, Chris Pitaro. And he's a guy who I could see as a very Royals fit because he's got a scouting background. He's kind of a guy who's been in the game forever. And he's kind of risen to the top of the A's organization and learned from Billy Beane. So he might be that perfect hybrid. And he's a guy who I really like the Royals to at least talk to if this happens. Now, we talked a little bit off air, so I think you'd agree with this, that they're more likely to promote from within. And I think your guys are J.J. Piccolo, Mike Arbuckle, and the dark horse, I think, is Scott Sharp. But, yeah, it'll be interesting if the Braves collapses. It's done. They're three games under 500 after leading the division as recently as, I think, the All-Star break. So that's a tough thing to recover from as far as Frank Wren's job is concerned.
The only thing I would question, I think Frank Wren's probably done. I don't think that hiring Dayton Moore for what we just said would make any difference.
Well, I agree, but if Schurrlitz wants it, Schurrlitz wants it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if that's who Schurrlitz, but I mean, to go out and hire the guy, basically the same guy on the same tree, I mean, Wren was on that tree, and to go out and hire him and hire Dayton, you just doesn't seem like you're getting much different. I mean,
it kind of feels like the Braves are heading down the Royals path, and you know the John Schurrlitz model, maybe it doesn't work when it's not John Schurrlitz. Maybe he's the only one who can do it.
I like what Dayton's done. It's not what I would have done, but they've built an athletic team, like Krasnick was talking about. They built an athletic team with good pitching, and I think there's more pitching coming.
I should stop you real quick. It's football season, which means Rich Gannon's on. So they built an athletic team. Not an athletic, athletic.
They built an athletic team.
Thank you.
No,
you're right. He's done a nice job of being ahead of the curve because
the games came back to them.
Right. And my question is, did they know that or did they get lucky?
I think it's a little bit of both. It's no question that it's a little bit of both. I mean, the games came back to them more than they probably would have ever anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
But that's hurt them as well. I mean, their best hitter from the past is all of a sudden a shadow of himself. Billy Butler's a mess. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
You know, and Alex Gordon probably has less pop than they were hoping. And Eric Hosmer.
Let's write this down to talk about what baseball in the off season, what baseball can do to up offense, which is funny because 10 years ago it was, what can they do to up pitching? But let's write that down. Let's have a little discussion about that in the offseason once this season's over.
Well, we already know what they can do. They can give them out steroids. They can wind the ball a little bit tighter.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not much you can do.
There are some things, though. I mean, you talk about...
I think a big part of the velocity is out of control. I mean, if you follow J.J. Cooper, the velocity nowadays is higher than it's ever been. He's got, I think they counted 20-some kids in the minor leagues that have hit 100 this year.
And it was like 20 in 12 years or something before that, or right?
Yeah, and it'd be like one or two a year, if that. And now it's 20-some are hitting 100. The Royals don't have anybody hitting 100 in their system, but they've got, today they've had Herrera hit it multiple times, and Davis was just shy a couple times. I mean,
yeah. That's an issue too, but I mean, again, we can talk about this in the off season, but I feel like there's there are things you can probably do to combat that, and it physically changing the game would be the answer. Do you move the mound back 2 feet? You know, I mean, I don't know. I don't think that's necessarily the right answer, but do you lower them or do you raise them or lower the mound? Does that make it a little bit less safe for pitchers? I don't know, but that is something we should maybe talk about in the offseason. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah, but to get back to the general manager thing, you know, I think Piccolo would have to be the big leader if that would happen. And I would be surprised if Dayton even took the job, to be honest with you. I mean, I know it's the Atlanta and that's where he started, but he's from this area. This is the reason he took this job. He's built this team to build this job. And if they make the playoffs, and I know people don't want to talk about it, if they win a World Series, Dayton's got a job for life.
Yeah. No, you're accurate. It is. There's a question. Would he take that job? And I don't think it would be surprising to me if he did, but I wouldn't go to Vegas and bet on it.
No, I wouldn't either.
It's interesting, though. It's definitely a storyline to watch for next season.
Yeah, it's a storyline to watch this offseason, but I think we all know what the storyline is to watch right now. And that's the end of the season playoff wrap.
Yeah, there's definitely some exciting baseball to be played here in this last week of the season. And I hope that, you know, when the next time we come to you, our loyal listeners, that we're talking about the playoff Royals and not the season that was, but the season that's yet to come.
Definitely. So we'll talk to you guys next week.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.